The reality for many of you is that investment properties where you live have become absolutely unaffordable. The good news is that there are many cities with affordable properties and many of those under 100K. If you're someone who's ready to buy your first out-of-state property in the next 4 months, then I encourage you to check out my free training that'll break down the process and show you exactly what it takes to invest out of state. I purchased properties out of state and it's changed my life. The same is possible for you. You simply need the right information. My free training will help you take that next step towards buying your first out-of-state property. You can watch the training right now at outofstatemoney.com, or you can click the link in the description of this episode. Again, you can find it at outofstatemoney.com, or you can click the link in the description of this episode.
Excuse me, may I talk to you for a second?
Yes. This is the Black Real Estate Dialogue, and the purpose of the Black Real Estate Dialogue is to document the journey of an up-and-coming real estate investor and to share the stories of successful Black real estate investors.
The reality for a lot of you is that investment properties where you live have become absolutely unaffordable. Here's the good thing though. Around the country, there are so many cities with affordable investment properties, some even under 100,000, so there's a lot of opportunity out there. On September 20th, I'm starting a 4-week virtual intensive workshop that'll show you how to buy your first out-of-state property. So we're gonna go over everything from creative refinancing that first property, how to build your team that you can trust, how to find and analyze properties, and how to find the right location, and so much more. You deserve to build wealth for your family. You deserve to invest in real estate. It's simply a matter of getting the right information. So I want to see you there. If you're interested, go to outofstatemoney.com/workshop or click the link in the description of this episode. I'll see you there. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Black Real Estate Dialogue Podcast, episode 186. A few quick announcements before we get into this week's episode. If you haven't already, please take about 10 seconds to leave us a 5-star rating and review wherever you're listening to this show. It helps us get this message in front of the whole world. And so definitely appreciate it and thank you in advance for your support. And if you do leave a 5-star rating and review, send me an email. My email is in the show notes. Send me a screenshot of your review and your rating, and I'll reply by sending you a free training on how to find and analyze properties. And so if you're somebody who is just starting out and you don't really know how to look for properties, you don't really know how to calculate cash flow, all those things, it's a great training that'll help you with that foundational information to get you going. So it's about 30 minutes as well, and I recently updated it to reflect the current interest rates, the current market, and all those things. And I actually have a review here that I want to shout out that we recently received from Vic E79. It says, great show. I just listened to the Charles Noonan episode and I'm excited to start this journey. I love the dialogue as well as the tips and tricks in this show. Looking forward to learning more. Vic, appreciate it. The review looks familiar, so I'm pretty sure you emailed me. If you haven't, definitely make sure to email me. I really appreciate you. All right, we are a little under 2 weeks away from my 4-week workshop, where I'll be breaking down exactly how you can buy your first out-of-state property. If you are somebody who is in an expensive market, this is definitely something that you do not want to miss. Go to outofstatemoney.com/workshop to get some more information, and I can't wait to see you there. All right, this episode was absolutely amazing with Tawan Davis. We spoke about so much good information and he's such a knowledgeable person. I really had a lot of fun in this interview. So I'm not gonna hold y'all up any longer. Without further ado, let's get into it. All right, everyone, welcome to another episode of the Black Real Estate Dialogue Podcast. If you're on YouTube, make sure you like this video, share, subscribe. If you're on audio, make sure you leave us that 5-star rating and review. It goes a long way, it helps us out a whole lot. Very excited for today's interview. Today I have with me Tawan Davis. Tawan, thank you so much.
Hey, it's good to be
taking
here.
Taking some time to join the show.
No problem.
How are you feeling today, man?
I'm good.
Good.
I'm good.
Definitely. Yeah. So, Tawan, let's jump right into it. So if you could just introduce yourself to the listeners, let them know who you are and a little bit more about your company.
Sure. My name is Tawan Davis, CEO of the Steinridge Group. We are an investment and development firm. Right now, we have about $500 million, roughly $500 million of active developments around the country. and we're growing that to about $1.2 billion over the next 12 to 36 months.
Definitely, definitely. So take us to the beginning of starting the company.
Sure.
I know you were in various roles prior to starting Steinbridge. So we'd just love to hear, one, why you decided to start the company and how the investing strategy has evolved since then.
Sure. Well, I started the company. We invested about $900 million in various office buildings around the United States, the most notable of which was the famous Watergate office building. That was the subject of Nixon's impeachment. We did that in about 2016. 2018 comes along. It's clear to me at the time that office isn't a growing part of the real estate space. That was even prior to COVID. It became clear that most office tenants were taking smaller footprints. They were competing with WeWork at the time. And there was already an early work from home movement. Mm-hmm. And so we found that having longer term, that most of the tenants were taking smaller and smaller office spaces. And so that became clear that if, you know, I started the business, I was 36, 35 at the time, and I wanted to be in the business for 30 or 40 more years. And it was clear that the office space wasn't an ideal growth part of the market for that period of time. And it became more apparent that the United States was perennially and perpetually underhoused, and that the real demand in the United States for real estate is in the housing space. We have underbuilt homes for the American family for at least a generation or two, and that's where the real opportunity and the need emerged.
Definitely. So you mentioned underhoused. Do you mean like single family, multifamily?
Right now we have three active strategies. One is single family rehab, where we go in, we'll go to a city, we will buy a cluster of homes in a neighborhood, we'll rehab those for rent, and then over time we will sell them to homeowners. Second is we have a build-to-rent strategy where we partner often with community institutions, nonprofits, sometimes churches, sometimes universities, and we will help them redevelop their land into economically productive uses. And we do that in large scale, and that's a build-to-rent and, again, eventually sale. And the third is an urban infill strategy, where in the larger cities that may not be single-family home cities, like mm-hmm. Manhattan or, you know, Harlem, for example, we will build, we'll do urban infill, multifamily, and other similar product types.
Yeah. It's interesting you mentioned the single family strategy, because I'm sure you know, like, a lot of people are like, multifamily or nothing. Like, yeah. Why would you buy a single family and all this stuff? What's your take on
that? Well, the single family actually is the American real estate business. So there are 133 million housing units in the United States. Of those 133 million housing units, 84 million are single family homes, roughly 62%. And so the almost two-thirds of Americans live in single-family homes, unlike Europe or Asia that are more multifamily markets. Of those 84 million single-family homes, 22 million are for rent. Now, the FHA and the HUD include anything that is four units or less as a single-family. So of those 22 million single-family homes, roughly 3 or 4 million are duplexes to quadruplexes. So there are, again, 133 million housing units in the United States, 84 million single-family homes, 22 million of those single-family homes are actually rental units. So it's, in fact, the largest investable asset class in the United States.
Wow.
Second, and certainly the largest investable asset class in the real estate space. It's second only to, I think, U.S. Treasuries and mortgage-backed securities. But as far as equity investments are concerned, single-family rental is the largest. It represents roughly $4.5 trillion of total investable assets. There are about $2.5 trillion of total apartments in the United States, and there's about 1.5 to 2 trillion office buildings. So if you aggregate all of the rented single-family homes in the United States, it's actually the largest investable asset class, which is why there's been so much institutional capital allocated to that space since the 2008 financial crisis, because it is, in fact, the largest part of the real estate business.
Definitely. So from your opinion, how do you think the 08-09 crash has impacted the lack of housing that we have now? Do you think it's related?
Oh, I think, you know, it's interesting because we are experiencing another economic challenge, right? We've got, historically high inflation. We have historically high and rapid increases by the Federal Reserve to the interest rate. And what we are finding is that home prices for the last 2 months still increased. Why? It's because of this basic supply and demand.
Yeah.
Despite the fact that interest rates are, mortgages are now 40% more than they were a year ago, despite the fact that that it's more difficult to build a home and to buy a home for someone, housing prices have actually gone up. And that's counterintuitive because in general, basic economics says that when interest rates go up, housing prices should come down. That actually happened for a relatively short period of time, but it's gone up. Why is that? It's because there aren't enough homes out there.
Yeah.
Because it is harder to build, it's more expensive to build, and the borrowing costs to build are higher. And so what you now have is what I call the trifecta of challenge for the American homeowner. The home prices are going up, they're not making as much money, and interest rates are up. And so basically you have these three challenges that are really making it more difficult.
Definitely, yeah. It's an interesting time. I mean, a lot of folks feel pretty discouraged with just, you know, the interest rates and the home prices and all that stuff. It's an interesting time, to say the least.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. My thought is that, first of all, we have to change our focus.
Mm-hmm.
So I think as African Americans, and we have to get away from being income focused to being wealth focused. So that's step number one. That's mental transition number one. You cannot pass a salary on from generation to generation.
Right.
So what? Yeah. So the difference for us is we have to become focused on wealth creation. So that's number one. There was a great one of the old Greek philosophers said that for any two folks to have an intelligent conversation, they must first define their terms. And I use that to say, what do we mean by wealth? Basic definition of wealth is what do you own minus what you owe.
Yep.
Whatever is left over is your net worth. That net worth determines your wealth. So that's where we are. I think that's the first step is to refocus ourselves away from being income and salary focused to being wealth focused, which means net worth. So that's number one. Number two is to understand some basic stark realities in the United States. So there's one basic stark reality is that the average American has a net worth of about $950,000, whereas the average African-American family has a net worth of about $340,000. So there's about a $600,000 difference. It's so roughly 3-to-1 difference. But that doesn't even really tell the story because that's the average.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm an economist and finance guy by training, so I'm a bit of a nerd. Averages are easy to manipulate because what you have is the averages being pulled up by the outliers, by the billionaires. So you need to take the median. The median is actually the number that tells the story, and it determines if you bump into a person on the street or at church, what is the statistical likelihood of their net worth? And for that number, it's actually $24,000 for African-American people and $189,000 for the rest of the country. So here's the fact, that that statistical person that you bump into every day is 1/8 as wealthy as their non-African-American counterparts. That's a fact. So that's the stark reality. That difference is about $164,000. And here's some basic math. African Americans arrived to the eastern shores of Virginia in 1619. If you had given every African American $1 every time they hit the eastern shores of Virginia and came to the United States, $1, and if you had allowed it to grow at 3%, the rate of inflation, from 1619 to today, it'd be worth $153,000 today. Why is that important? It's because time is money. The biggest thing that African Americans lost is time. We had 350 years, during which African Americans could not participate in ways in which people make, save, and pass along money. The United States economy started in 1619. It's 400 years old. But the African American economy started with the Civil Rights Act, 1964. So the African American economy is only 60 years old. So that gap that we see in the net income is actually a function of time. It's simple return on the dollar, right?
Yeah.
So what we find African Americans trying to do today is we are trying to catch up on 400 years of being excluded from the basics of the American economy. And that's why real estate is such an important part of that. Real estate is an important part of that. The whole GDP, real estate and related activities are worth roughly 15 to 20% of the American GDP. It is the biggest way to get yourself out of poverty in the United States of America. It's not having a good job. It's owning real estate. Now, I'll add to that. You take that 20%, every American family, roughly 30% of their net worth is in their home.
Yeah.
And they can pass that along. So I appreciate the fact that you're doing this. I know that you've had some very important and impactful men and women on this show. And the reason it's an important conversation is because we are trying desperately to close a 350-year return on cash gap. That's what we're trying to do. We're not trying to get rich quick. We're not, you know, African Americans are just as smart and just as hardworking as everybody else. What we lack is time. And we know that in order to make money, it takes time. So the most straightforward way to do that in the American economy is real estate. Not all of us are tech geniuses, but everybody can own a piece of real estate.
Definitely. Yeah, I agree with that. Something I tell people sometimes is one house can change your life. You know, imagine, you know, someone who has a home and they would have passed it on to their children. Sure. And so on and so forth and leverage it. And do. There's so much, it's unlimited what can be done.
Sure.
Starting with one piece of real estate. So, you know, I think, you know, it's important what you're doing as well to make it possible for more people.
Sure. I mean, you know, what our focus is, so, you know, we control roughly $500 million worth of real estate today, which seems like a large number, at least, you know, from our perspective, to try to manage and to produce. But we think of it one house at a time, right? So we're thinking of it one family, one house, and then helping people walk the path from rentership to ownership. So we started we recently started a relationship with PNC. That collaboration allows us to help people walk the path from rentership to ownership. And PNC provides low down payment loans. They provide down payment assistance. They will give financial literacy courses. They provide buying support. They also waive certain requirements, like a series of fees that they often have. And one of the bigger things that they do as well is they waive the deposit requirement. So usually you have to have 6 to 12 months of deposits in the bank to get a mortgage, and they waive that requirement. So as long as you can make the minimum. And then if all of that fails, we have the resources to lean forward and close the financial gap. So that was important to us, is because it helps people walk the path of rentership to the path of ownership.
Definitely, definitely. Is it starting with like your current tenants?
Roughly half of the folks that have signed up in our initial pilot in Philadelphia have rented from us in the past, and half have not. Yeah. Half have, you know, found out about it through the discussions we've had and through the brokerage network, and have reached out and said, you know, we'd be interested in participating. So it's not necessarily limited to our tenant base.
Definitely. I love that. And Philly was where you first invested when you transitioned from the office space, right? Mm-hmm. What was some of the data and trends and things you saw in that market that made you want to start there?
Sure. So Philadelphia, if you look at, one of our foci is to identify neighborhoods that are in transition. And again, I, as you can tell, I'm very analytical. So we looked at the last three decades of census data. And we looked at where in America the neighborhoods are in rapid transition, to the extent that the folks who are from those neighborhoods can no longer afford to be there and are being quickly displaced and aren't being able to participate in that rapid change. Well, there are a few zip codes in Philadelphia that always make the top 10 or 15 of all of the zip codes in the United States for those transitions. A couple of neighborhoods are Point Breeze, for example, Brewery Town, University City, all of those areas that are about a mile to 2 miles from the center of hospital, another area called Graduate Hospital, about a mile to 2 miles from City Hall. And those neighborhoods were such rapid transition. And we thought, man, if we could figure out a way to build a bridge to that transition, I don't know that we have the resources, the know-how, the political power to stop gentrification. But what we can do is build a bridge to transition and allow the people who are in those neighborhoods to participate and stay if they'd like, and then own a home in that very same neighborhood if they'd like, while the value of that neighborhood increases.
Definitely. I love that. And correct me if I'm wrong, I believe the way you all structure things with your tenants is that the rent doesn't exceed one third of their income?
Correct. Yeah. So we don't do rent to own. Mm-hmm. It's rife with all kind of challenges. So the rental contract is a lease like all other leases. Mm-hmm. But if that person expresses an interest, we will help them to make a transition. And that's when they start with our brokers in Philadelphia and in with PNC. But our goal is that according to HUD and to the FHA, if you pay more than 30, maybe 33% of your income in housing costs, you are rent burdened or housing burdened. Mm-hmm. And so we try to structure our homes to where no one is paying more than roughly 30% of their income in rent. And that's true not just in Philadelphia. We have a development in Texas. We have development in Virginia and other parts of the country, and we have the same target there.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's important because a large reason why people can't save to buy that home or to do different things or to just get a break is because they're paying so much in rent, especially in these larger cities.
Larger cities, the prices
are just going up.
50% of people in the major cities are housing burdened, which means that they're paying more than 30 to 35% of their income in rent. And then the challenge is, I mean, you know, again, getting back to the net worth numbers, African Americans have a median of $24,000 in net worth. Non-African Americans have a median of $188,000 in net worth. But 20% of African Americans have a negative net worth, which means that they owe more than they own. And so if you are constantly chasing that on top of your housing costs, it's very difficult to get out of that hole. And so we think that, and if you add to that the fact that African Americans were particularly challenged by the 2008-2009 housing crisis, we think that, you know, our focus is to help people kind of overcome those particular challenges in the market.
Definitely. So one thing I want to ask you about is raising money. A lot of people have a hard time doing that. It's nerve-wracking, and I'm sure you've had to raise a considerable amount to keep things going. So talk to us about just your experience with raising money and any tips you may have for someone who aspires to do the same.
That's a great question, and one that I was not expecting. So I have to let me see if I can give you a thoughtful answer on that. I've learned a few lessons.
Yeah.
Lesson number one, always be raising money. Always. Good years, bad years. Business going well, raise money. Business going poorly, raise money. Have a team, a structure, a strategy around raising money. Just like you have a team, a structure, a strategy around producing a podcast, you have a team, a structure, a strategy around finishing the house. You don't just go out there and start swinging a hammer. You hire a contractor. You might need an architect. You might need an expediter. You might need a roofer. You just don't go out one day and start swinging a hammer at a house. In the same way, you have to have a strategic, deliberate plan around raising money, and you have to do that every single day. And what I found is that participation in the capital markets for us is the hardest part of the business. When it's interesting, we can get our hands on some great real estate that no one else can get their hands on because it's in our neighborhoods, we're working hard, we're nearby, we understand, we have great relationships. We can get good crews together because we know where the good workers are, we know who the good contractors are, we've been in the neighborhoods for a while. But the challenge often for African-American developers and real estate investors is where do we get the capital? And that is, you have to have as sophisticated and as strategic and as persistent a plan around capital raising as around anything else. We have literally raised tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars to bring our company from where we started. Matter of fact, hundreds of millions of dollars to bring our company from where we started to where we are today. And that is in part because I've learned the lesson early that, I made a mistake. For about 2 or 3 years, I stopped raising capital. I said, oh, we're doing well. We're gonna prove this point. We're gonna round trip this investment. We're gonna demonstrate our success. That was a mistake. Soon as I raised that capital and started putting it to work, I should have gone out to the next batch. You should always be raising money. And I think that is the one thing that I find that most folks are not doing. Mm-hmm. They're thinking of the capital raising as an after the thought. Let me get a good idea. Let me get a good piece of real estate. And our counterparts don't do that.
Yeah.
They raise $500 million and don't own a single piece of property. You know, don't have an idea, don't have an architectural plan, don't have anything under contract. They go and raise the money first. Now, it's harder for us. We don't have all of those relationships. There isn't as much capital swashing around in our individual networks, but there is enough to get started. So my thought is you just have to be as deliberate about capital raising and have as sophisticated a plan, program, and team around capital raising as around anything else.
Definitely. I appreciate that. So one of the themes that I'm picking up in our conversation is just that you care about people. Mm. And obviously, we're in America. We need to make money.
Sure.
But it doesn't have to be without caring for people. And when we first spoke last week, one of the stories you told me about was your grandmother.
Sure.
When she moved to Oregon and bought property and things like that. So I would love if you could share that story.
Well, so I grew up in Oregon. And of course, everybody's going to say, well, I didn't know there were any black people. Well, I was one. And my family, when the Great Migration, when everybody else, and lots of families moved from the South to the North, people went to Philadelphia and to Detroit and to New York. My family went from Arkansas to Oregon. And in fact, if you read a great book called The Warmth of Other Suns, it tells the story of the Great Migration. It has a particular section that talks about the migration of folks from Arkansas to the Pacific Northwest. That was my family. In fact, I didn't meet anyone from Virginia or whose grandparents were from Virginia or whose grandparents were from South Carolina until I went to college. Everyone I grew up with, all of our ministers, all of our barbershop owners, all of the hairdressers, all of the African-American business leaders and political leaders, they were all had roots in Arkansas because that's the way the Great Migration spilled out onto the Pacific Northwest, Oregon, and Washington. So that was my family. So in the 1930s, my great-grandmother, who was a sharecropper in Arkansas, her grandmother had been a slave in Mississippi. They began to make these trips from Arkansas to Oregon, and they would—they had to drive the long way. They couldn't go the diagonal from Arkansas to Oregon because at that time there was an unknown. There were unknown places in the middle, like Utah and Idaho, right? And so they didn't know how friendly or unfriendly those places would be to people of color. And so they drove a route that they knew, hostile nonetheless, but it was at least a familiar road. So they drove west. They got to Texas, drove through Texas, and then they drive up the I-5 corridor to California. They did that about twice a year. And they would go back and they would get family members and friends, and they would bring them back to Oregon. My grandmother bought 4 or 5 houses. Her sister bought 3 or 4 houses. Her other sister bought 3 or 4 houses. And so these women between them owned somewhere between 9, 10, 11 homes in the neighborhood. And they'd go back, they'd get folks from Arkansas. They'd bring them back. They'd let them stay in these homes until they got on their feet, and then they would help those folks get on their feet, buy a home, and then they go back and get them the next batch. So they did that for 20, 30 years, right up through the 1960s. I still meet people, often seniors, who will bump into me and say, oh, you know, I stayed at your grandma's house. And when we first came from down home, they call it. We stayed with your grandmother up on Cook Street or on Cleveland Street was where my great aunt lived, which was, you know, walking distance from the first. And so it was a powerful example of collective progress. And I grew up with some just amazing, amazing women. I knew my great, great grandmother.
Wow.
Was born in 1896. And she was the youngest of 11 children. I just have amazing women who really showed me the right direction.
Definitely. I mean, I'm sure they'd all be very proud that you're carrying on the family way and continuing to help other people.
Appreciate that. Yeah. So that's that.
Definitely. So what are the future plans for Steinbridge?
Well, it's interesting. We hope to, right now we are in the process of growing quite a bit. We have active projects in Texas, Virginia, Pennsylvania, New York, New Jersey. And we're looking at Georgia as well. As I said, we have about $500 million of active developments and rehabs. We're looking to grow to about $1.2 billion over the next 24 to 36 months. And then our goal is to be a leader in impact investment with real estate as the first mover of that impact. We see the very strong connection between real estate and real estate ownership and job opportunities and healthcare and economic productivity and education. And we think that real estate is a great bedrock for that. So we'll, over the next few months, we'll be announcing some rather impactful strategies around both our rehab and our build-to-rent businesses.
Love it, love it. So about $500 million in projects going on. How many assets under management roughly, you guys have roughly?
Right, roughly 3,000 units today are under active development. Yeah, so if we add them all up, they're in different stages of building.
Gotcha.
3,000 units.
Mm-hmm. Dope, dope. And then how about like what you guys currently have, like the current?
Right now, geez, I'd have to get you that
roughly
because it changes every day.
Yeah.
So I would say we're about, I don't want to give you an estimate. I would have to give
you
that.
Yeah, you're good. You're good.
Because also because, you know, you can't raise money on TV, so.
You're right. You got
only so much I can say.
Gotta play safe.
Yeah, you know, the SEC comes after you if you do too much. Yeah.
Definitely. So what keeps you balanced? What keeps you grounded? I mean, you got a whole lot going on and you know, the company's growing and great things are happening, but how do you stay balanced? How do you stay grounded?
Everyone in my company knows one scripture, and I quote it all the time. Psalm 90, verse 12. Lord, teach us to number our days that I may incline my heart to wisdom. Lord, teach us to number our days so that we may incline our hearts to wisdom. So David is quoting Moses. Moses said that to the children of Israel when they were wandering around the wilderness.
Yeah.
And his thought was, man, Lord, help us to remember that life is short so that each day we don't act like a fool. So that really is one of the driving forces in my, it became clear to me that life was more than about accumulation and about self-gratification. That when my time has come, I wanted to have made the maximum impact that I feel called to make. So for me, real estate and this work is more of a calling than a job. And I approach it almost evangelistically. I've been asked twice to run for Congress. My father is a minister. My grandfather was a minister. So I could have gone into the ministry like they did. But for me, the opportunity was to impact the lives of our people through business, because that seemed to be where, once the sermons are over and the votes are counted, that seemed to be where we were still lacking. You know, it seemed to me like the next frontier of civil rights and the next frontier of our collective salvation is in our pocketbooks. And so, you know, that became clear to me when I was 15 years old.
Wow.
And I remember asking my grandmother, again, very religious family, grew up with much eventually. My mother raised us by herself after my parents separated, so I was just us. And I went to my grandmother and I asked her, you know, and it's interesting because, you know, these women, they built this community in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, but by the time I came along, communities had deteriorated. Right? We had the riots in the 1960s after the MLK's assassination. We had the disinvestment in the 1970s. You had drugs in the 1980s. And then in the 1990s, you had gang violence. So in fact, when I was growing up in Portland, Oregon, my town had some of the worst gang violence in the United States. Governor Wilson, who was governor of California, Pete Wilson, passed the three strikes you're out rule, which basically meant that there was mandatory sentencing for certain offenses. That moved a lot of the gang violence from Northern California, so Sacramento, San Jose, Oakland, up to Oregon and Seattle, Portland and Seattle. So we had terrible gang violence. And I remember, and so these neighborhoods had deteriorated. We were hitting the floor every now and then. And I remember going to my grandmother and asking her, you know, the Bible says that the cattle on a thousand hill belongs to God. I said, I don't want a thousand hill. I just want one hill. In fact, if God would give me one cow, I think I could figure out the rest. And so for me, it has been a very deep calling of mine to try to figure out how to get our folks out of poverty, how to close the 350-year gap of theft that happened in every African-American pocketbook, and how do we close that gap in the most impactful and efficient way.
Love it. Love it, love it. Wow, that's got me thinking a lot. Wow, that's big. That's big.
Well, you know, it's interesting because it's the first time, last time I told that story, I told it to a group of young people.
Mm-hmm.
I started talking about my grandmother, and about halfway through, I was in tears.
I mean, so you got me close now.
This is the first time I've been able to tell that story and not come to full tears. They had to, it was funny, we were at the state, asked me to give some talk, and all, mm-hmm. You had about 300 or 400 young folks around. I started talking about the time, about my grandmother's migration from the South, and started talking about this story about when she, you know, took the cattle on the Thousand Hill, and started talking about when she looked at me, and you know, they used to call me Buddy. That was my nickname. It wasn't Tawan. They called me Buddy. My grandmother, she had a deep Southern accent. She could almost never say Tawan. And so one day she looked at me and said, Buddy, you going to be something. Last time I told that story, man, I burst into tears in front of 300 people. So I got better. I'm practicing now.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Is there anything else you want to share with the listeners?
You know, I think that you've asked some good questions, and I think that we have largely. Is there anything else you want me to cover? You think that you want included in the discussion?
I think we've covered a lot. We covered just about everything I had in mind and some. But I think, you know, this has been a great interview, and you know, I think the impact investing, your approach is very unique. I mean, I talk to people all the time, and I haven't heard even one person saying they want to limit the rent to a certain percentage of the person's income, which is looking out for both parties, yourself and for the tenant. So I think that's great among all the other great things y'all are doing. So I know the listeners will definitely love this episode.
Cool. Well, I appreciate it. Thanks for having us. And, let me think about capital raising. That's the one thing you could do a whole series.
You might have to come back and do another one.
Around that subject. I thought about this today.
Yeah.
There hasn't been $1 billion raised and invested by an African American real estate company in probably almost 20 years.
Wow.
The last one, I know you had Victor on, and he and Quentin Primo, who was, forget the name of Quentin Primo's company out of Chicago, but they were probably the last multi-billion dollar African American real estate investment firms. That hasn't been done in a generation. Hmm. So the opportunity and the need is more acute now than it's ever been. And I hope that, you know, either us or somebody listening to this podcast or yourself can help close that gap and reignite the fire under the fire of possibility that exists in our community.
Definitely. We need it. We need it. And where can folks keep up with you, keep up sure. with Steinbridge and everything that'll be coming?
So I just got Instagram.
All right. Cool. Cool. Welcome.
I'm middle-aged now. So yeah, I was behind.
No worries.
So my Instagram is Tawan W.T. Davis. Tawan W.T. Davis. And then the Steinbridge, Steinbridge, has its own Instagram account as well. We also have Tawan Davis on Twitter and Steinbridge on Twitter. We have Facebook. Tawan Davis and Steinbridge. And I think that covers it. And of course, there's Thread now. Everybody's got Thread. We got Thread too. Steinbridge and Tawan W.T. Davis on Thread. And we've become pretty active communicating our strategy and trying to communicate some of these ideas as of late as well.
Definitely. Awesome. Well, Tawan, definitely appreciate you taking some time to join the show. I'm looking forward to playing this back and listening to it again. So we'll definitely have to do another one. And I really, really appreciate you taking the time.
No problem. Good to be with you. Thank you for having me.
Definitely, definitely. Right. Thank you to everyone for listening to another episode of the Black Real Estate Dialogue podcast. Definitely, if you're on YouTube, make sure you like, share, subscribe. If you're on audio, make sure you leave us that 5-star rating and review. Thank you all so much. Look forward to hearing from you all soon.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Black Real Estate Dialogue podcast. Remember to follow us on Instagram at Black Real Estate Dialogue. And be sure to leave us 5 stars and a review on your favorite podcast listening platform. Until next time.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.